Welcome back, folks. This is Mark Steiner here, and good to have you with us on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And I'm glad you could hear part two of our continuing series, What Brought Us to the World That Brought Us, Freddie Gray, produced by the students that Stephanie Mavronis and I are working with at UMBC's American Studies program. We'll hear the next part in that series tomorrow at 10 a.m. Right now, we are launching into one of our conversations we've been having for a while, over a series of months. We'll continue them. The Baltimore Uprising 1 year later. Today, we're going to focus, our first program focusing on economic and development alternatives. There have been a lot of battles in Baltimore City over, during this mayoral campaign, and since Freddie Gray, about how you change things. You've seen groups in the city from different organizations who took over a house, Tubman House in Baltimore, trying to create a different model for what a community can look like. There are arguments here over questions of, do we need more workers' co-ops in Baltimore, when we are seeing Port Covington kind of launching and marching its way through all the city approval processes. What does that second city of Baltimore being built across the water, what will it mean for the rest of Baltimore? Does it have inclusionary housing? Does it have jobs? Does it build workers' co-ops? Does it open opportunity for black-owned businesses, women-owned businesses, Latino-owned businesses inside that world? And what does that mean if it did? And what are the larger issues that we need to debate about the question of economic development in our city? How do things like municipally owned utilities fit into a conversation in Baltimore City? Is it a city bank on the as there's a state bank in North Dakota and other cities are attempting these banks? Are land banks part of the answer in terms of redeveloping our communities? How do we make real change? Can we continue doing it the same old way? I had a conversation yesterday which a little off the side, but not really. Maryland passed legislation saying that marijuana legalization for medical use is in the city and in the state. And then you look at the people who are getting those contracts. There are the people like David Cordish and others who are in the front of the wealthiest people in our community who are at the forefront of that, saying you have to have $30 to $40 million to open that. And what does that say about the ability to open that process up for entrepreneurship, especially among especially in the black community in Baltimore, where some people are making the strong argument that if you take these young men off the corner and give them an opportunity to build a new kind of business, why shouldn't they have that business? So there's all kinds of issues here that tie into what a real change means. And we are here with Kim Schuhart, longtime citizen activist, retired U.S. military person who ran for president of the city council, and in her walking through the bus stops and on buses, got 34,000 votes, which, did I get that right,
37,000 was the final count.
Sorry, Kim, 37,000 votes, which is a huge amount for somebody who spent like 10 cents a vote.
Yes, sir.
If that.
Absolutely, 10
if that. Lawrence Graham Prees is in the house. He is Assistant Director of Research and Public Policy for Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle, co-author with Dave On Love of the Black Book, Reflecting from the Baltimore Grassroots. Good to see you, Lawrence, once again in the house.
Thank you. Always good to be here.
Jeff Singer is with us, founder and former executive director of Healthcare for the Homeless. Jeff, good to have you here as well.
Thank you, Mark.
And joining us by phone, by Skype, actually, is Sarah McKinley, who's manager of community development programs for the Democracy Collaborative. And Sarah, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888. You can also tweet us at Mark Steiner, send us emails to talk@steinershow.org, log on to our Facebook pages. But leap in with your ideas about how we change the economic situation in Baltimore, where we have 77,000 people who are unemployed, many more who are underemployed, where communities are devastated, many communities in the city. Half the people in the city of Baltimore live at or near poverty, and what those struggles mean, how you change that dynamic, and can you change that dynamic given this current economic situation. 410-319-8888 do join us. So, you know, we see this promise in the city. Seven new council members coming on. Eight new members, but seven of whom will most likely be people who have never been in politics before. A rip-roaring general election ahead with a strong Green candidate taking on the Democratic candidate. These issues are coming to the forefront as they have in this campaign. So what do – let me just – a quick overview. What do we mean when we talk about an alternative economic development? How do you define that? I mean, because we have – you know, I mentioned like seven different areas where it could be. Let me get a national perspective and then we'll come around the table here. How do we define what we mean by searching for alternative economic development that actually has an effect on the welfare of people's lives and deals with the question of both racial and class exploitation in our communities, especially racial exploitation in our communities as well? Sarah, you take first shot at that?
Yeah, sure. Thank you very much, and thanks for that great introduction. At the Democracy Collaborative, we talk about something, an approach to economic development called community wealth building. And let me just say that community wealth building is not a new concept. We've just sort of tried to knit together a lot of activities that have been going on at the community level for many years, largely because, as you said, the economic system as it's structured in our country is really not working for communities, and particularly low-income communities and communities of color. So for generations, or definitely for the past number of decades, communities have been coming up with alternatives as they can that serve them. So, for example, community development, financial institutions, community land trusts, different strategies that really work to root economic activity in the communities where they're based. So community wealth building is really a lens that knits all these different activities together and really gives them a sense of cohesion with drivers such as, for example, rooting ownership locally. So we focus a lot on different forms of ownership, such as I mentioned, community land trusts, but also things like worker cooperatives and different forms of financial institutions like credit unions and community-owned banks and municipally-owned institutions. So when we talk about community wealth building, we talk about collaborative, inclusive, rooted ownership that can help ground economic activity locally. So a lot of these things have existed in communities, but sort of on the fringes. And I think as our community, as our communities just keep getting generationally impoverished, and these solutions are not the traditional solutions, the way economic development is done in our country that usually is oriented towards giving subsidies, tax subsidies to large corporations to come in and create jobs that aren't actually rooted in the community, that don't hire people from the community. As we are realizing that fails our communities, a lot of these quote unquote fringe activities are coming to the fore as real solutions, not just for one community here or one community there, but for every community. So we really do think that this is the source of the solution. And if we knit these together and support them through policy and through government support, we can really get them to scale. And you're seeing that happening in a lot of cities across the country. Of course, you know, our political climate right now is not very hospitable to a lot of these efforts, especially at the state level. However, you are starting to see these solutions bubble up at the city level. So I hope that's a helpful sort of map of some of the things we're seeing across the country.
No, I think that was a great overview, a really strong overview. And let me, Lawrence Grand Prix, take us to break with your thoughts, and then we'll come back for Kim and our good friend Jeff Singer.
I think I have a little bit of a different perspective. I think it's similar, but I think there are some critical distinctions. I think that be it in traditional economic development policy or even in terms of alternative economic development policy, indigenous folks in community are viewed as appendages of larger apparatuses, usually external, usually white controlled. So while traditional economic development policy sees residents of Baltimore as, oh, we'll bring in Under Armour, we'll bring in Amazon, and then you can work the warehouse and make the lattes, I think there's a I'm worried about sort of philanthropic homesteading, to be honest with you, after the uprising where folks come in and we have this similar framework where we say someone outside of Baltimore has to come in and fix our problems. We get enamored by folks bringing really good-sounding economic policy or nonprofits or There was a big venture capital firm that's apparently coming to Baltimore now with some help from the Able Foundation. It's the same mentality that I think needs to be criticized in terms of not viewing indigenous folks in Baltimore as being central to the infrastructure and the context of the solutions to social and economic problems, and viewing them as appendages of either larger dominant-controlled businesses or dominant-controlled nonprofit institutions. So while I agree with a lot of what was previously said, I think there's some very critical distinctions and critiques that need to be hashed out in terms of what exactly is community wealth building. Because I probably have a bit of a different perspective than the person from the Democracy Collective.
We're going to take a very short break and come back and talk about, really get into what community wealth building means. But after we hear from both Prim Trueheart and Jeff Singer, and you at 410-319-8888, let's design what the city should look like. Stay with us. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. I am here with Lawrence Grand Prix, Assistant Director of Research and Public Policy for Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle, Sarah McKinley, who's Manager of Community Development Programs for the Democracy Collaborative, Jeff Singer, who is Founder and former Executive Director of Healthcare for the Homeless, and Kim Schuhart, longtime activist who ran for President of the City Council and is involved in trying to build their own kind of co-op movement here in the city with rehabbing houses. And you can join us here, 410-319-8888. So, Kim, let me go to you with your kind of overall vision, overarching vision, and then go to Jeff Singer.
You know, I've given this some thought. And, you know, rooting ownership locally, what does that mean and how does that occur? You know, one of the things I was asking myself, and I need to do some more research, is how many of those corner neighborhood stores are still owned by members of the Black community? And, you know, when I grew up, there were a lot of them. They were all over. You know, every neighborhood had multiple stores that were owned by someone of the neighborhood. And and now they've transitioned, and we don't own them. But those few who are left, we need to invest in them and build them and keep that capacity and that wealth in the neighborhoods and in the family. The other thing that I think is interesting is this $535 million TIF going to Under Armour and Sagamore. They could have had partners, right? Minority partners involved in this. And we have these things called community development corporations in many of our neighborhoods who have been trying to develop capacity. A great example is Cherry Hill. It has a Cherry Hill Community Development Corporation. It could have been a partner to Sagamore in this whole development initiative. It could be this concept of mentoring, shadowing a big successful company, getting this small company, you know, they've developed housing in Cherry Hill, the Community Development Corporation. They worked with Enterprise and Rouse to develop some of the townhouses down there. So it would have been wonderful to take this local neighborhood group that has been struggling to do housing development in their community and incorporate them into this process. Some other things that we need to look at is, you know, the city council. You know, the city council right now has a piece of legislation called the Inclusionary Housing Law. That law does very little to actually build. I think the number is 34 units have been built. You know, so there are things that I think that we can do locally.
And of course, the inclusionary housing piece that in the city has to pay for that, not the developer.
So why don't we change that?
Right.
So
that's the law at the moment, right?
Sort of.
Go ahead. Yeah, Your overview, Jeff Singer.
Overview, golly. Baltimore has a very long history of cooperatives, by the way. It goes back to 1794, as best I know. And then, of course, the famous Frederick Douglass Isaac Myers cooperative. They also created a National Colored Labor Union, you know, a couple years after they started their shipyard cooperative. And cooperatives are, I think, an important part of an alternative and democratic economy, but they can't be the center of it, from my perspective. And community wealth building won't be meaningful until wealth is no longer created by exploiting labor. You know, we had a We had an American once who said labor is prior to and independent of capital. This is an American. This is not Karl Marx. capital is only the fruit of labor and could never have existed if labor had not first existed. Labor is superior to capital, and it deserves a higher consideration. And you know who that American was? Abraham Lincoln. You know, we have a critique of Lincoln, but putting that aside, as long as there's a division between labor and capital, in a capitalist society there always will be, then cooperatives aren't going to fundamentally change the issues of inequality and oppression and racism and sexism that we have to deal with.
So, okay. So starting from the point, folks, do join us here at 410-319-8888. I really want to see what ideas you have about where this conversation goes and where the city could go. And where, because Baltimore being emblematic of cities across America, not just about Baltimore, this entire nation, there are things that are happening all over the country where people are trying to struggle with this very particular issue. But so given that we will probably not be rid of an oppressive, racist, and class capitalist system in America any time before I draw my last breath on this planet, and maybe even not when Lawrence Grand Prix does, who's considerably younger than I. So what then are the alternatives that you have as we try to make a society, a city, where people live decent lives and don't have to live under this kind of racial oppression and class oppression that many people live in this city? And so let's define for a moment what we all mean by community wealth building. What does community wealth mean? Who defines it? Who owns it? What effect does it really have on the kind of larger lives of the community beyond just, you know, one or two projects that may be launched in a neighborhood? I think, which is, you know, we because we have these kind of wonderful piecemeal ideas across the country, but what are they? I do want to go to Sarah, but let me start with you, Lawrence, and let Sarah jump right in.
I think I have a somewhat concrete example that exemplifies how I see a difference. I think that the Democracy Collaborative model is really interesting. I've studied the Evergreen model just a little bit. It includes things like having worker-owned cooperatives that access critical points within anchor institutions. For example, I believe it's Cleveland. They have all these hospitals, and they need laundry. So why not have people from the community form a cooperative and do the laundry? I think that's a really good model. I think that there are grassroots models that are a little bit different. I think the issue of that model is it continues to view oppressed communities as appendages of larger institutions, cooperatively organized, perhaps more democratically controlled, but still appendages, and it ignores the economic, cultural, and policy agency that's happening within communities right now. So, for example, John Morris, who has worked a lot with Sojourner Douglas College, has a model he calls the Promissorium. It basically says that right now, even within impoverished Baltimore, there are economic agents that are generating millions of dollars of economic activity within these so-called oppressed communities. And intuitively, this makes sense. We all know people who do hair, who sell CDs, who do graphic design. What is the mechanism that actually empowers those individuals to be invested in and to form perhaps ersatz cooperatives that may not have the formal large overhead and mechanisms of larger formal cooperatives, but ersatz cooperatives where they can continue to circulate their economic entities and get access to the market they already have, which is the black community? So he talks about forming a cooperatively controlled credit union, which can suck up, that can bring in the unbanked and aggregate local resources and then do sort of business accelerators that are that incentivize forms of cooperation that views a local black economy as its core market, not as an appendage to a larger dominant-controlled institution. But even poor neighborhoods in Baltimore, for example, Old Town, it's seen as an impoverished neighborhood, has over $100 million of economic activity in it, but it's not being captured or circulated. So I think that circulation within black communities is a critical metric of community wealth building. And the last thing I'll say is that I think that models like the Democracy Collaborative model, I think, can be good. My issue is who controls that apparatus, because those nonprofits, whether we want to admit it or not, are themselves forms of wealth creation. And if we have so much overhead and capacity invested in nonprofits that don't represent the community, then we're ignoring the fact that folks in the community can run those institutions themselves.
So let me turn to Sarah. What's your response to what Lawrence said?
Well, first of all, thank you, Lawrence, for articulating that. I think everything that Lawrence has to say is really powerful and a necessary criticism of the Evergreen Cooperative model. And of course, the Evergreen Cooperative model is one model of how community wealth building can be done. And of course, for those who don't know, the Evergreen Cooperative Models, as Lawrence mentioned, is a network of worker-owned cooperatives in the city of Cleveland that supply goods and services to local anchor institutions, hospitals, and universities in Cleveland, employing residents in the communities, largely communities of color around the anchor institutions. Of course, as Lawrence mentioned, it is a fairly institutional, or it is an institutional driven and therefore top-down model in many ways, with these this different introduction of sort of democratic ownership and new forms of ownership. So I absolutely agree with Lawrence that the key question is who is controlling these models. And so, in fact, you know, the goal ultimately would be to have the community drive that. And so what does that look like is a question. And I think every community is going to do it differently. And what the points of leverage are in that community are where you can start to drive things. For example, we're actually working with a partner in the Twin Cities, Nexus Community Partners, and they are a community-based organization, and they are very focused on community engagement and authentic community engagement with a lens towards racial equity and cultural, you know, cultural context. So their goal, they are using a community wealth building frame, but they are using it in a way that they are bringing community partners to the table and allowing them to shape the goals of the community wealth building strategy using the assets of their communities and working from the needs of their communities. So the goal that Nexus is trying to work with community wealth building is to have the community drive the engagement with the institutions and the apparatus. It varies from community to community, and again, you have to work with the leverage points that you have, and how you can you know connect the institutional power, the wealth, if you will, and bring that to the table with the community actors and the community-based organizations, so that they can connect to that, and then in theory help drive that, if not completely drive it. You know, ideally, you would want a community wealth building strategy to be driven by the community. You haven't seen that as often, unfortunately, and you know, power dynamics come into play everywhere. So you know, it's something that we haven't quite seen yet, but it's starting to happen. We're actually doing work also with indigenous communities, Native American community-based organizations, to develop community wealth building strategies in each of their communities, and it's very, very different from the Evergreen model, and it's very much oriented towards what their particular assets are and their needs as communities. And then just to comment on something that Jeff said, I really agree with him that co-ops are not the answer. They have to be part of a systemic shift, and of course, who owns and controls capital is the big, you know, elephant in the room. And until we shift that ownership of capital in our economic system, it's you know, it's sort of, if you will, banging your head against the wall. So we at the Democracy Collaborative also focus very strategically on what we call the next system. So thinking about how all these different efforts that you're seeing coming from communities can be knitted together and start laying the groundwork for a new economic system that's more sustainable and community-rooted. So, you know, the idea is that practice informs theory, and that theory can push practice to the next level. And I think as a country and as community actors, we need to start having those conversations about system change more openly and pushing that conversation, up to the decision makers, to the policies and so forth, because that's the real question. Until we change that system, we're not gonna see real change at the community level. So we have to have that conversation as well.
Yeah, I look at this in terms of our ability to move forward. And I think we're going to have to do this incrementally. And I think leveraging what currently exists in terms of economic development means we're going to have a piece of it. You cannot exclude us. Yesterday at the Board of Finance, they were talking about these bonds and where the money would be vested. And the bank that they identified was Bank of America, right? They didn't identify Harbor Bank. They didn't identify a locally owned bank. They said Bank of America. So here they're signing all of these agreements to put the money into this international bank when we really should have put it in some local institution. You know, we've got to take advantage. You know, here's this 535, and this is all local for me, right? This is a $535 million development project, and I want a piece of it. And yes, I agree with Lawrence. I love his perspective on things, that it's got to be organic, it's got to be locally controlled. But until we get to that point, let's leverage what's out there. And so this development opportunity that the city has right now needs to become more inclusive. It's got to be building the capacity that we need to get to where Lawrence says we need to be. I want us to get there, but we're not going to get there if we're sitting on the sidelines. And right now they want us on the sideline, and I refuse to allow that.
So, well, go ahead, Jeff. Do you want to jump in with your
thoughts? Well, thank you all. You're all expressing important concepts. I would add perhaps that maybe we need to act on three levels at the same time. This morning I started to draw up a little table of this, but I was distracted by needing coffee. the events and activities that are going on that we need to stop, those we need to build, and of those we need to build, some are very local and some are national and international, right? So the ones we need to stop are the continuous giveaways to billionaires, not just Harbor Point, which was a giveaway to someone who's becoming a billionaire, not just Port Covington, in which we're giving a man who alone can afford this development out of his own pocket, and yet the city claims to have a but-for analysis that, no, he can't do it unless we give him money. That's crazy. And we have a housing commissioner who says we will waive our inclusionary housing ordinance for him when that's completely unnecessary too. If we look into the details of how that ordinance works, although it's a horrible ordinance, our housing commissioner and our mayor have not used it in a productive way. The 32 units they've created, not one of them is for a purpose.
Exactly.
Not one poor family has gotten housing out of that. So, but let me move on. We need to stop that kind of thing. But we don't want to put all our energies into stopping. We want to put energies into building. Well, I think it is important to build democracy in communities and even in individual business enterprises or nonprofits. And in fact, that's what Healthcare for the Homeless was. We were a little socialist nonprofit right in the middle of Baltimore. And one of our principles was the people who worked there should be part of running it, and everyone should earn a living wage. And the distinction between the top wages and the bottom wages were reduced dramatically. There were other principles, too. The clients should be part of running it, and the clients should determine their own treatment, and that's called harm reduction. But we need to do that. But we didn't succeed in getting other nonprofits in Baltimore to do things that way, unfortunately, although it's still a campaign. I see cooperatives creating them as part of that same campaign, building democracy in a very, very local place. But if we don't at the same time build it on a national and international scale, then, as Sarah mentioned, we'll be beating our heads against walls. I don't think you can build socialism in one enterprise or one city, and maybe not even in one country.
So let me kind of parse some of this stuff out here. When we talk about community wealth building, I'm going to stay on this for a moment. I really want to come back to some of the more specific issues about controlling money inside of a city, the kind of alternative banking systems that can be created, controlling municipalities, how do you develop without giving money to developers to develop? And in a few minutes, I'm going to hit those three issues before we get to 10:30. 10:30? No, 11:30. I don't even know what year it is sometimes, 11:30. So let me – just one critical question here that has gone back and forth, but I don't think it's kind of bubbled up. From what Lawrence was saying and hearing Sarah and Kim, what you all were saying about this. So – in a city like Baltimore, where 60+% of the population is African American, and that over up to a half of the population of Baltimore City, most of that being African American, lives in or near poverty in this city, but there were also a very strong black middle class throughout this town as well. Can an economy be built that effectively helps change the existence of black working class families in this town to participate plus build wealth and do it solely in the black community?
Yes.
I'm not so sure. Well, let me push a little further. I would say, because I don't know any other business model in America, on the capitalist side here we're talking, right, that has ever done that. Ever done that.
Because it never had the intent to do that. It was always about profit making. And so if it is the intent to help build and uplift a community, then you're going to take a different business approach, right? But if the intent is, I want to get rich, right, then you don't care about bringing along those folks who are underserved and poor and destitute.
Yeah, and I'm going to parse out your question just a little bit. I think when people hear me talk about entrepreneurship, there's some just like pejorative context that people have around the term black capitalism. And I think what people think I'm saying is that there are enough black money and black businesses where if we just bought black, somehow that would rise. The rising tide would lift all black boats and all black people would be okay. That's not what I'm saying.
I didn't think that's what you were saying, but go ahead. Go ahead.
Some people in Radio Land may think that.
Right.
I'm saying that. You need to – Ms. Trueheart is exactly right. We cannot expect the existing economic system – this is John Morris's quote – to produce an outcome it was never designed to create and it's never shown that it can create that. So it's not so much important to me like where the seed investment comes from. But the important context is who controls it and what is the design of the model. Because what we need is an economic ecosystem where it becomes in people's – not just their best interest, but it becomes logical for them to buy locally and to have folks who are empowered to make decisions who have the majority in communities control the institutions in those communities. And in Baltimore, that looks like black communities controlling institutions in black communities. And so we talk about a community land bank, trust, not a bank, trust. You're talking about a decision you have to make, whether you're going to do rental property in that land trust or whether you're going to do opportunities for ownership models. And I think when you talk about ownership models, you're talking about black community wealth creation. Now, that may not be entirely black because maybe you get seed money from somewhere. But the people who have control of that trust need to be black. And odds are the people who will get the benefits from that trust will also be black. And it should be designed to facilitate that model because right now, just look at a TIF. If you have a TIF, you actually have a huge incentive for massive amounts of gentrification because the more valuable the land is, the more tax money you get back to pay off your initial investment. So you want to bring in the folks from out of town. You want to bring in the folks from D.C. And that is a problematic model because it denigrates the possibility of local communities being seen themselves as the generator of wealth and economic activity in the community. So, again, I think we're talking about distinct models. None of them are clean, but I think the racial lens is essential in terms of framing how power works.
Yes, the racial lens is essential in this United States of America and in Baltimore City, without a doubt. So let's take a model for a moment. I'm going to come back to this idea. I think maybe a whole program just talking about that means would be important to have Lawrence others on here to debate this out. But because in the time we have, let me just pick a model that's in Boston. So in Boston, you have the Dudley Street community, which is a community land trust. That is essentially run, from my understanding and my visitation there once, by residents in the by the majority of the folks around that are black, Latino, and Cape Verdean who are running that community project. And so what has been the success of that model? And how easily has it been to replicate that model across Boston or any other places or across the nation? Or is it just isolated example? But people throw Dudley Street out a lot. So Sarah, very quickly describe Dudley, and then let's leap into this for a moment about what that model means, what it might mean. Go ahead, Sarah.
Yes, sure, of course, and thank you for bringing up the Dudley Street model. The Dudley Street is essentially a community development corporation based in Boston, and they worked with the city to use eminent domain to claim land for a community land trust for residents of their community. And of course, it's been very successful over the past 20 years, one of the more successful urban models of community land trusts that we've seen, and a showcase for the rest of the country. And it's been fairly successful in creating wealth through home ownership for, as you said, the African American, Latino, and Cape Verdean communities there in that area. And in fact, a number of the original youth leaders of the Dudley Street Initiative are now John Barrows, who was a youth leader with Dudley Street and then went on to become their executive director, is now the economic development director for the city of Boston. Unfortunately, a lot of his more progressive efforts at Dudley haven't really translated at the city level yet, but what you are seeing is sort of the movement of community actors and leaders into positions of policymaking authority at the city. And, you know, hopefully if you see more of that, you start to see sort of leveraging of those policies in those directions. And I know that John Barrows has been doing some work around explicitly African-American-owned enterprise in the Boston area. So it's an interesting model. Again, I imagine, you know, the question Lawrence would have is, you know, how much of that continues to be directed by community residents as opposed to, say, city leaders and other things like that. But it's been very successful in generating wealth for through housing ownership for that community.
So let me just – this question I have, Jeff, because you've raised this on the show before, and I just want to just jump into this. I mean, how you take – all right, so what happens to things like Dudley Street and other models like this is they remain models. That they affect the communities that are around them and within them in really very strong positive ways. But it seems to me that the only way that a Dudley Street model, whether it's in Baltimore City or any other city, becomes effective is if it becomes part a part of city policy, that this is how we're going to develop the city and not just make it kind of a symbolic project. Symbolic may be the wrong word to use, but
Sarah knows more about this than I, I'm sure. But last time I investigated Dudley Street, they had labored for 20 years in a very democratic way with doing a lot of hard work, and it produced about 200 units of housing. And maybe they've produced a lot more by now, but this wasn't long ago that I did this research.
200.
And 200 units of housing is important. I mean, we could use 200 units of affordable housing in Baltimore for sure, but they
could use 20,000 units is what
exactly.
We need. Right.
They put an awful lot of work into creating 200 units of housing. And yes, there's some wealth building for the Dudley Street community, but I don't know that it's been expanded throughout Boston. I don't think so. Every student at the School of Social Work where I teach sees a video on Dudley Street, and everybody gets really excited.
No, it's amazing.
About it.
Right, right.
But can we make the kinds of massive changes that we need to, where in Baltimore there are 98,000 households that can't afford their rent every month? The Dudley Street model, maybe there's some way to expand it for that, but I think so long as capital is actually owned by the 1% and controlled by the 1% who are white males, as long as that happens, we've got to struggle, as I mentioned, on all these levels all at the same time.
Yeah.
Okay, so we have to take a short break here because it's time for a quick news break. We're going to come right back. But I'll let you come back, Kim, because what I want to explore here, and folks, Andy, the first caller up at 410-319-8888, want to get your thoughts on this. But what I want to explore is, what do you do in a – take Baltimore as an example. If we wanted to make that community development model the model for the city, what would that mean and how would you do it, given the 1% controls the capital? Hold that. We're going to come right back to it right after this news break. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. This is actually the first in a series of conversations we want to have here about how you build an alternative economic models in a community like Baltimore that can actually have an effect on the population and change the power dynamic in this city. We are here. You heard Sarah McKinley before we went to break, manager of community development programs for the Democracy Collaborative. Jeff Singer, who is founder and former executive director of Healthcare for the Homeless. Lawrence Grand Prix, assistant director of research and public policy for Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle, and co-author with Davon Love of The Black Book, Reflecting from the Baltimore Grassroots. Kim Trueheart, who was a candidate for president of city council, city activist, and is working on launching a company that is built around the co-op model, redevelop houses in the poorest communities in Baltimore. And you at 410-319-8888. I promise we'll get right to the phones here, but let me just finish this where I left off. So then how do you take this land trust idea and create a economic and development model that is broader than just a model, that actually redevelops neighborhoods, puts people to work, and gives people, whether it's owning a cooperative apartment house or whether it's owning an individual home, how you change the nature of ownership and all that, right? So how does that begin on a massive scale? I don't mean piecemeal. We're always piecemealing. That's, I think, we keep thinking piecemeal. So, well, how politically do you put that on a massive scale? Is that even possible?
You know, I'm not mad at Michael Beatty or Kevin Plank, right, for not wanting affordable housing units in their upscale. No, I'm not, because what that gives us an opportunity to do is, if we have the right people in office who are supporting economic development across the city, they will say the monies that would have gone into their developments will now go to a community development corporation in the poorest sections of the neighborhoods. Let's invest that in them and let them improve the housing in their particular neighborhood. So we're leveraging this opportunity. Now, ideally, yeah, it should be a mixed income, you know, very diverse neighborhood that Port Covington produces, but that's not what they want, right? So I'm not willing to fight them as long as they're willing to write a check to us. And they need to write a check, put it in Harbor Bank, right? Let Harbor Bank and part of these agreements that are being inked right now need to say that as a minority partner, these community development corporations, which are owned and run, as it were, by blacks, are going to be the beneficiaries, and that they will lead the development using those funds in our neighborhoods. That's one step towards this greater model that we're looking at. And why can't we insist on that?
Yeah. Real quick, I first want to say, here's what you don't do. What you don't do is go to established nonprofit entities that have no formal mechanism of accountability and do not represent the community. Give them a bunch of money to say, let's make Dudley Street a citywide model. And what you don't do is you don't contract folks from out of town to say, you have the knowledge, bring your knowledge to us and create sort of a savior model out of folks with this magical knowledge. And you don't make the community a minor appendage of this effort by tossing them a percentage of the money that goes into it. Because that's the dominant model of how we do things here in Baltimore. We're working with the city now, and it's driving us up a wall. Every time we make this argument, they say we agree, and they do the same thing over and over again. That's what you don't do. Here are some things you could do. You could, as Ms. Trueheart brilliantly pointed out, leverage existing economic policy and TIFs to have a more democratic impact. Right now, we don't have a culture of hard negotiation on these issues. We're like, please come in and save us, so we'll give you anything. And the community, seeing that, often says, well, just give us a rec center. Just give us something. When we need to say, no, there are more substantive demands that can be made, be it a donation to a cooperatively controlled pool of money that gets reinvested into the community, mm-hmm. or a guarantee that black businesses will have exclusive space to actually retail in that venture. So not just making them an appendage of the actual construction, but creating wealth creation opportunities guaranteed for the community out of this. Another thing you can do, you can change the rules on TIFs. Maryland has some of the most lax rules on TIFs in the country. So we don't have strong regulations on them being targeted to aggrieved communities, which they were supposed to be. We don't have strong statewide but-for regulations. And we don't have any sort of context on using TIFs as they were originally meant to to have a mechanism to get capital in communities that otherwise would not have that capital. So you could change those rules to use that as a mechanism, which would not require tons of money. But the last thing I'll say is you have to use policy creatively, and you have to have a movement that forces politicians to take stances outside their comfort zone. A quick example of that. I think that the Democratic candidate for mayor is a very solid person to execute the current system of politics in a competent way. But I think people are looking for more than that. They're looking for genuine policy innovations that could address this. So, for example, I say it all the time. If you're going to have marijuana legalization or marijuana, medical marijuana, there are tax receipts that come from that. And a competent legislator will say, well, let's create a good, solid system. Let's bring in the technocrats to manage this policy. Pushing someone to make actual policy change that is more, I guess, revolutionary would say, look, this tax money is being created. There are communities that were decimated by the war on drugs. Look at Sandtown, for example. So if we have these tax receipts, good policy and ethics mandates that we allocate a certain percentage of that money for marijuana legalization or for medical marijuana to be reinvested in communities most impacted by the war on drugs, and that the people who are from those communities get access to that money to help rebuild those communities. And I think Tubman House is a good example of the kind of agitating Democratic tactics you have to engage in to push politicians to that space. So I think there are lots of solutions, but the state is the entity that has the scale and capacity to do it, but they can't use the current model of politics to do it. They have to rethink the way in which they understand power and race to actually get to that place.
So let me turn to Jeff and then Sarah, and then we're going to go right to hear these first two callers up, Andy and Fred. We're going to get your calls in right after this. Can that model be developed?
Well, then I should be brief, but I like what Mr. Dupree just said about it. We have to engage with the state because the state is where capital makes its voice heard on the biggest scale. And we've just not done a very good job of that. I was so discouraged by the Sun's interview with Catherine Pugh, nice woman, but she seemed to answer every question they asked with the wrong answer. She described the current structure of the Board of Estimates as being an amenity for the mayor. Oh, my gosh, it's not like choosing whether you're going to have marble in your bathroom. It's trying to create a little more democracy, you know. To take all of this to scale, we both have to do it on a local level and we have to get the levers of power at the state level. Now, how to do that precisely is something people have been arguing for the last several hundred years. But unless we work at both at the same time, we're going to fail. And I do want to use just one example, which is the University of Maryland Biopark, because that's now being used as a model of how you get the community engaged in a TIF. But the truth of the matter is exactly the opposite. In fact, a billionaire company is building this building at the University of Maryland Biopark, $40 billion at Blackstone, $40 billion. The lint from the pocket of the CEO could spend that $17 million. There's no reason in the world, there's no but-for analysis that can tell us that they couldn't do the project if they wanted to. And then on top of that, the employees at the University of Maryland don't make a living wage. The president of the University of Maryland at Baltimore earns $950,000 a year. Yeah, yeah. And the low-level employees at the University of Maryland don't earn $25,000 a year. We haven't used the word union much today, but one of the ways that we expand democracy and create wealth throughout the community is by strengthening our unions and let them be a democratic voice for equality and for democracy in the workplace.
You know, so, Jeff, you keep throwing – I have to say this.
We have very little time here, so I need to –
go ahead. Kim, go ahead. All right. You keep throwing out this wealth disparity issue about the CEO and the worker. You know, at Healthcare for the Homeless right now, the CEO, the director, makes $175,000 a year. I'm sure the workers don't come close to that. That's a nonprofit.
I don't work there anymore.
I understand you don't, but let's like talk about this, because in the nonprofit industrial complex, we have that kind of crap going on in this city, and it is so frustrating, especially the ones that are white controlled, right? The ones who have a profit motive in the nonprofit world. okay? They have been abusing us for years, for decades, right? And it's continuing today, right? If they're really about serving us, building wealth, giving us access to resources, you can't have that on the table and justify that you're doing good for us. No, you're not doing. You're doing good for yourself.
I have a question about that, but I don't want to go on. Let me come back to that. And Sarah, let me you thought on this a bit about how you take these things to scale, and is that realistic? And then let's go back to the phones.
Yeah, thank you. And this is really rich conversation. And how do you bring it to scale? I think a lot of the things that we tapped on and I think we talked about earlier, sort of taking a different, you know, multi-pronged approach. So, you know, you have to redirect a lot of what's already happening at the same time as you're pushing from the bottom and then also creating sort of new policy and new approaches. I thought that Lawrence's discussion of legalization of marijuana, not only are there opportunities to capture that tax generation, but also there are opportunities to create new entities of enterprise and structure as you develop ways and means of producing and selling legalized marijuana. I mean, one thing we need to talk about is not just having large corporations dominate that market. How can we introduce things like cooperative models to the enterprise development that comes with legalization? So I think exploring new avenues like that. But again, we need to look at the capital ownership and see how we can redirect it. If as you said, in our lifetime, we're not going to see an utter shift of that capital ownership, but how can we redirect it and do things like create revolving loan funds and other points of access into that capital? How can we redirect state funds? How can we redirect federal money coming through states to cities so that communities have more control of it through things like revolving loan funds and other things like that? And then also, Tim was talking about the nonprofit industrial complex. Well, part of that is also the hospitals and universities. These are publicly owned or nonprofitly owned institutions that have enormous wealth in communities. And that's not just the way they hire and they purchase, although that is a huge leverage point to redirect, but then also how they invest. Lots of institutions have endowments and they're investing their money. Where is that money going? Can they invest in local institutions? And really understanding how these institutions operate in your community and applying pressure to redirect. So, they have self-interest in residing in stable and healthy communities. So how can you leverage that self-interest to redirect to the communities? And that's something that we at the Democracy Collaborative focus on a fair amount, is how can you get institutions to the table to understand their economic impacts and redirect it? And redirecting those, sizable economic generators can really shift things and move to scale. But that has to happen at the same time as the community is applying pressure, applying means of accountability, applying transparency, and then at the same time as policy and legislation is developing around it. So, mm-hmm. So as Jeff mentioned, these have to happen at multiple levels at the same time.
Let me go back to the phones here. We have not got the phones. Let me do that. 410-319-8888. Andy and Fred, you're both coming on the air here. Andy first, line one.
Hi, Mark. This is Andy Ellis.
Hey, Andy. How are you?
Good, and hello to all your guests. So I'm co-chair of the Baltimore Green Party, and we have been working on these policies for a long time this summer. We'll be unveiling them. A lot of policies focused around localized economic, workplace democracy, participatory budgeting, and things like that. As our platforms come out this summer, we're really looking forward to pushing the policy debate with Catherine Pugh and Alan Walden on these questions. I guess the question that I have for your guest is how do you see the injection of these issues into a mayoral race raising the awareness and raising the profile of this debate as we go forward toward November?
Good question.
Yeah. I think it's rich. I think that the conversation has to occur. And as we've said here this morning, we aren't engaged in that conversation sufficiently in this city. You know, the institutions that Sarah was talking about, they inked a payment in lieu of taxes agreement with the city 5 years ago, and it expires next month. And that payment in lieu of taxes says that the hospitals and the institutions of higher learning will pay the city, instead of paying taxes, a small sum of money. And that small sum was no more than $5 million for all these institutions that were a party to this agreement over the 5 years. And it was a declining payment, right? So the new agreement was signed, I hear, very recently, that I haven't been able to get a copy of. But the new agreement doesn't change that dynamic much. It's still a minuscule amount of money that's coming in to the coffers. And I'd like to see that money directed. I'd like to see those institutions step up to a greater degree to serve the underserved, where they're sitting there using our infrastructure, our systems, and don't have to pay for it. So why not give back more?
Yeah, I agree. And quickly, I've also tried to look at that pilot money. It's like Chase and Casper. It's hard to find it. And I think part of the reason why it's hard for them to renegotiate the pilot is because the politics of it. You have very strong institutions that have very strong mm-hmm. ability to donate to campaigns and to influence policy debates. So when you have the power come from a democratic locus of the people, that means the politicians have more or are forced to stand up to those institutions more. And I think that looking at just the numbers, I mean, what's 37-38% of 44%? You know, so Casper and Pew may claim a mandate, but the numbers don't genuinely reflect that mandate. So there are a lot of people in this town who didn't vote for Casper and Pew. So if she does become the next mayor, I think that that's a lot of people who need to hold her accountable and that she should be wary of in terms of voters who have not signed on to her message at all. And these are the issues that are holding a lot of them back, because we don't see the type of genuine leadership that could push those funds back towards the community. Also, real quick, Obamacare had a mandate for health institutions to reinvest in community. And it'd be nice if politicians mentioned that point, as opposed to always having to be advocates mention that and actually push that point.
Let me try to get another caller in here at 410-319-8888. Fred, you're on the air.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning, Fred.
You know, first of all, I think we need to realize that poverty is an industry, and they're never going to do anything to solve the problem. Can you imagine how many people would be out of work if they ended poverty tomorrow? That's not going to happen. I think our community really needs to get itself together, pool our resources, take all our money out of all these different banks, put it all in one bank, get ourselves some contractors, go into the city, buy up these vacant properties. You know, just constantly begging and talking about what's going on. It's not. I've been in Baltimore for 67 years. Do you know how many hundreds of millions of dollars have come through this city supposedly to help black poor people? Remember the empowerment zone money? Are you still there?
I'm listening to you. We're listening to you.
You know what I'm saying? These are all great ideas. You want to negotiate this. You know, Kathy Pugh could care less about the people of Baltimore City. They do look at a record. He voted for 40 different taxes. And you know, I can go on and on about what she's done over the years. She don't care about the people in Baltimore City. All she cares about is being the mayor and maybe later on trying to be something else. So for us to pretend that we can go to the table to talk to her about anything, this is just a big mistake. So, as I said, I think we need to stop, get off of this wagon of what they're going to do for us and see what we can do for ourselves.
Thank you so much for your call, Fred. Appreciate those thoughts. Thank you so much. I think that I mean, there's a lot been put on the table here in the last over an hour of this conversation, and I think that some of the questions seem to be very deeply political in terms of who controls the policy and where the money goes. You know, I was thinking about what you said about wage scales before. I mean, I think I was thinking about this as a little digression. I was thinking about what you just said when you were talking about health care for the homeless. But I mean, I take the Ben and Jerry's model when it comes to private capital companies. Mm-hmm. The CEO makes. Can make more than five times the lowest paid employee. Mm-hmm. So if lowest paid employee at some place like healthcare for homeless or any place else is 35 and he's making 175 or she's making 175. I mean, you can build that kind of equity in the company so nobody walks away with nothing.
Yeah. But that's a board and leadership issue.
But it is. But it is. But I think that the overarching question, when I was talking about what Fred said, and I don't know if I agree so much. I don't think poverty is an industry so much as poverty is the nature of this capitalist society and that people make an industry out of living off the needs of poor people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that has become – back in the 60s, we would call that the poverty pimps.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that expression from back in the 60s? I mean, so that was – because that was kind of the notion that people made a gigantic salary – working to uplift poor people while folks didn't get lifted nowhere.
And we have that in Baltimore, very, very prominent here in Baltimore. You know, one of the things that, you know, if there are so many boards and commissions in this city that make decisions and policy, and we've got to get seats on those boards.
So let me get this. We have like 6 minutes or so left. I'd like to get a closing thought from everybody here very quickly about where you think the next level of this discussion needs to go and where it has to be pushed to build a more equitable society in our communities like Baltimore. Kim, since you started, let me let you make your closing thought and we'll go around the room, all right?
You know, I'm hopeful and I have to be hopeful that folks like us will continue to raise the issues and the conversations, inform the public, and give them opportunities where they can actually engage in moving us forward. As I said, you know, a moment ago, you know, there are boards and commissions. You know, I got chastised yesterday at the finance board for making a comment when there is no period of public comment at that board. Every other board allows for public comments, right, periodically. So why not the finance board, where they're looking at borrowing billions and billions of dollars, right, for the city, but yet there's no public comment period? Let us get involved.
Yeah. I think that there are lots of grassroots efforts from people who have established residency in Baltimore and put in lots of work here. I'm worried about, for lack of a better word, co-option, where, again, you have sort of particular hand-chosen black and brown faces being held up. This is black enterprise. This is the institution-approved black business incubator or the institution-approved version of the pilot or the TIF, right, or the community benefits agreements. Genuine grassroots engagement means sometimes dealing with people who didn't vote for you, who don't think like you, and maybe you don't like them. But this is the community, and there are lots of people here. There's a Black Business Incubator in Sandtown, Black Arts Incubator, Peer-to-Peer Incubators. All these projects are on the table. Some of them are, for lack of a better term, shovel-ready. But that would mean investing in people who maybe don't share your belief, maybe won't toe the political line. But if you actually care about empowering the community, that's what you do. You don't force people to jump through political hoops to prove that they're willing to bend the knee to your political establishment. You actually invest in the people who are here, not the people you like who are here.
Sarah McKinley, you have a few minutes left. Your closing thought.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with the folks on the panel that this is an incredible moment, as Kim was saying, she's positive. You know, this is a moment. We at the Democracy Collaborative really think this is a historic moment. I think you're seeing it across the country right now in our national politics that people are hurting and in pain and want an alternative and they don't want the same old. Now, of course, the way that's playing out on national politics may not be to everyone's liking, but the reality is still there that communities are hurting, and it's becoming clear that business as usual, quote unquote, is not working. And I do think, you know, this is a moment that communities need to seize, to apply pressure and direct attention and take advantage of this moment for real alternatives. And that's happening. That is happening. It's happening at the city level, at the community level, and we just need to connect those dots and bring those efforts together. And I think we can really start to see a shift change in the way economic development is done and hopefully ultimately in the way our economy is structured.
Final thought, Mr. Singer.
Perhaps the example of healthcare for the homeless is, in fact, instructive because we were trying to build a democratic, socialist, anti-racist, feminist organization. I think they still are probably the only nonprofit that has a living wage as the floor for employees. But still, that model hasn't spread throughout the city or the world. And if we don't work at all of these levels simultaneously, a difficult challenge, then we're not going to achieve the justice and equality that we seek.
I want to thank the four of you. This has been a fascinating conversation. I'm really important. We want to continue here during not just the mayoral debates going on here in Baltimore City, these city elections, but just with our sister cities across the country as well, kind of getting into this dialogue about where how we change the economic dynamic of our society. So I want to thank Sarah McKinley joining us, manager of the Community Development Programs for Democracy Collaborative, Kim Schuhart for being with us, longtime activist, about to get knee-deep into trying to build a different economic model in community, Lawrence Grand Prix, Assistant Director of Research and Public Policy for Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle, and Jeff Singer, professor at the School of Social Work at the University of Maryland and founder and former Executive Director of Healthcare for the Homeless. Thank the four of you so much.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you.
We're taking a brief break, and we'll be joined by A. Dwight Pettit and Doug Colbert to talk about what's happening in Officer Nero's trial coming up this week.